This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brian Eno is well known in the worlds of rock and experimental music. He brought ideas from the classical avant-garde into the world of rock. In 1971, he co-founded the British band Roxy Music with Brian Ferry. Eno played synthesizers and electronically manipulated the sounds of the other musicians in the group. Eno left Roxy Music, made albums on his own, and started his own label that recorded albums of atmospheric electronic music, which he described as ambient music. He became an important figure in the new wave scene of the 70s, producing records by Talking Heads and Devo. Eno has also produced records by David Bowie, Robert Fripp, and U2. His new CD, Spinner, will be released next week. It's a collaboration with world music fusionist Ja Wobble, which reworks the music Eno composed for the film Glitterbug, directed by the late Derek Jarman. I spoke with Brian Eno in 1990 and asked him to describe what he calls ambient music.
The whole ambient thing really arose from watching the way that people were listening to music as opposed to the way that composers were making music. There seemed to me that there had developed a big lag in between those two operations. Composers were still making records as though people ran back home with the disc or the CD and sat down in front of their speakers with their attention riveted and listened to every detail and nuance of the recording. Well, of course, that used to happen, but and it still does. It's rather the classical music model of listening. But what more typically happened is that people would buy the record, take it home, put it on, get on the phone, do the washing up, vacuum clean, do all the sorts of things that one does. Write a letter, read a book, and have the music on at the same time. So I thought it was quite clear to me that people were using music much more as a form of landscape, really.
Mm-hmm.
They were creating an atmosphere for themselves by means of music. And I thought also that most music was not designed with that idea in mind, and in a certain sense it didn't work very well for that job. So I wanted to make a music that could allow you to do that, that could occupy different attention spaces in your life so that you could stop and listen to it and give it that kind of old-fashioned attention, or you could just have it playing and get on with something else.
You have a record that is still a work in progress now. You're still working on it, but we have mm-hmm. a couple of tracks. And mm-hmm. I want to play something that you've called Ripples in Time. Mm-hmm. Would you put this in the category of the ambient music?
Yes, I would. That piece isn't quite finished yet, but I'm hoping, in fact, I'm trying, I haven't succeeded yet, to add a 16-piece string orchestra to this piece. And we've done a little work on that, but it hasn't quite worked out yet. So this could become rather a different piece from what it sounds like at the moment. But it certainly fits in that same category, I think. Ambient also is rather a good alibi for slipping what can be quite abstract pieces of music to people in a way that doesn't intimidate them. You know, if you say, hey, you know, this is nothing in particular, just you can treat it as background music if you like. It gives you a certain freedom to operate outside of any of the known sets of expectations about what music should be. So I'm kind of interested in using that category as a way of generating a kind of post-classical contemporary music. And I hope that pieces like this will be the beginning of that.
Well, let's listen to Ripples in Time, and this is a work in progress by Brian Eno.
Thank you.
composer, musician, producer, and synthesizer player Brian Eno is my guest. Now, you came to music from art school when you were still a student. You were in art school. You didn't play an instrument. You didn't read music, but you had a synthesizer, which of course is an instrument, and you were using a tape mm-hmm. recorder, I think, in very musical ways, manipulating it. Mm-hmm. How has that continued to shape your sense of who you are as a musician? Do you still think of yourself as a non-musician, even though you've been playing music for so many years?
I do, I suppose, yes. I think that, the tape recorder was certainly the most important thing for me, because the tape recorder, as far as I was concerned, turned music into a plastic art. It meant that it was possible to do all sorts of operations to sound that didn't actually require traditional musical talents. So I started out working in music with quite a different idea about what music could be, and that idea hasn't really changed. It's just been enlarged, but at the basis I still have this feeling that music is now a new art since the tape recorder.
Well, it's interesting to me that you have this, pretty avant-garde sense of what music is or can be, and you've chosen to take that concept to pop music as opposed to, say, the classical avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of your ideas initially would have been much more at home in the classical avant-garde because there were other composers there thinking along similar lines, where it was very unusual to find someone with ideas like that in pop music.
Yes. I had quite a strong connection with the classical avant-garde at first. That was really my first musical connection. When I was art college, I was in contact with people like Christian Wolff and Cornelius Cardew, and of course I knew what Cage was writing about and so on. So that was sort of the license which allowed me to think that I might be able to do something in music, because a lot of things they were talking about were for non-musicians or for unskilled players, that kind of thing. There was suddenly an idea in the mid-60s that you didn't really have to have gone through the whole academy in order to be able to play music. It was not quite so mysterious. And then at the end of the 60s, a pop group appeared that had a very big influence on me, which was the Velvet Underground, of course the band that John was in. And one of the things they kind of traded on was a mixture of talent from Maureen Tucker, the drummer, who was really a non-musician. She normally played one drum. to Sterling Morrison and John, who were both very good musicians, and Lou Reed, who was maybe somewhere in between. And this, they made quite a point of the fact that this was permissible and in fact could lead to exciting results. Now, I was temperamentally always attracted to popular music. It was what I liked and what I listened to. And I liked the ideas of classical avant-garde music, but I must say I discovered that that was not what I was listening to for sound. For sound, it was pop music where it was happening for me.
My guest is composer, musician, and record producer Brian Eno. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Brian Eno. Let me get to another aspect of non-musicianship. You produced the Portsmouth Sinfonia record or records, and this was an orchestra of musicians who really couldn't play and who would play classical war horses like the William Tell mm-hmm. Overture or Thus Spake Zarathustra. And it was, like the most ragged assemblage you'd ever hear. Did you organize the band?
No, that was the brainchild of Gavin Bryars, an English composer. And it was called the Portsmouth Sinfonia because he was teaching at Portsmouth College of Art, and that grew out of that place, but then it attracted a much wider membership. At our peak, we had, I think, 80 members in the orchestra. And our biggest ever concert, we had an 80-piece orchestra and a 320-piece choir. We did Handel's Hallelujah Chorus at the Royal Albert Hall. But I just must correct something, actually.
It
wasn't, funnily enough, it wasn't entirely non-musicians. The rule with that orchestra was that anybody could join. Now, they could also be musicians. They didn't have to be non-musicians, but anybody could join. But the rule was that if they joined, they had to turn up at the rehearsals, and they had to try their hardest to play it right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, given that most of the players had absolutely no... Most of the players, I should say, had no musical background, this was guaranteed to fail in an interesting way. But some of the players were actually very skilled, and this was what made it musically interesting, I think, because occasionally you'd hear a thread of very nimble playing amidst this near chaos that was going on most of the time.
Is that what made the project interesting to you?
Yeah, I liked, I loved that. I learnt a lot about music playing in the Portsmouth Symphonia, more than probably any other experience I've had. Because if you get people who can't play instruments very well trying to play melodies that they know, everyone knew the tunes, you know, they were always Beethoven's Fifth and, as you say, the war horses of classical music. Probably the only thing they'll manage to do is to follow the rough shape of the melody. They'll go up when it goes up, and they'll go down when it goes down, but not by the right amount more often than not. So what you got was classical music reduced to its to a sort of statistical averages where you know, where the sum total was kind of roughly recognizable. It was a very exciting orchestra to be in. We fired a couple of people because they played around. The one thing that wasn't tolerated was people deliberately making jokes or trying to make it sound funny. It sounded funniest when everyone was trying hard to get it right, and it didn't sound funny when people larked around and made silly noises, you know. So we really did rehearse, and we realized that the quality of the failure depended on how hard we tried to succeed. And we tried very hard.
Brian Eno is my guest. Have you ever gone through a crisis of becoming too proficient at either composing or at using the electronics that you use or tape manipulation? You know, coming from this non-musician background and being informed by the Portsmouth Symphonia stuff about how something sounds when you're really trying hard to do it right and mm-hmm. you can't.
Mm-hmm.
People like you get really good, you know?
Well, it's a good question because I think what happens, it's not so much the over-proficiency that's a problem. It's the lack of alertness that goes with knowing how to do something well. Once you know how to do something quite well, or you're familiar with doing it a lot of times, you automatically are falling into routines. You know exactly how that works. You switch it on, you do this, you do that, you do that. And all of that is sort of done on automatic. And While you're on automatic, you're not listening any longer. One of the reasons that people who don't play instruments well are sometimes able to do surprising things with them is that they're listening at a much more basic level than skilled performers are. They start asking questions like, hey, does this sound interesting? Yeah, it does. at quite a different point from where the professional performer would. He's already been through that. He's already working at a level where he considers all those questions have been answered long ago. They're not interesting to him anymore. So I think this is the problem. It's not proficiency. It's the switching off of your alertness that goes with thinking you are proficient on something. So the trick is to think of ways of surprising yourself back into hearing freshly again.
Brian Eno, he has a new CD to be released later this month called Glitterbug. Our interview was recorded in 1990 after he recorded an album of songs with John Cale. Here's one of those songs.
So somehow it seems it was all enough.